Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, hormones, dirt, and tinkers. When men grow breasts and male fish develop ovaries, you have to wonder what gives with Mother Nature. These abnormalities stem from compounds that mimic hormones in our bodies. And for Dr. Hamid Habibi of the University of Calgary, tracking down these endocrine disruptors is one of the biggest health and environmental issues of our time. And in Edmonton, soil scientists from around the world have gathered for the 7th International Symposium on Soil and Plant Analysis. And Bill Kay retires. For more than 3 decades, this professional tinker, as he calls himself, has developed projects for the Alberta Research Council. And despite his official retirement, he still wakes in the middle of the night, his mind brimming with ideas for new inventions. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Growth and reproduction are regulated by the body's endocrine system. But sometimes, things interfere with the functioning of our normal hormones, and that leads to abnormalities and disease. Dr. Hamid Habibi of the University of Calgary has been researching environmental substances that are called endocrine disruptors, and he's developing a system that will allow other researchers to quickly detect and analyze the thousands of chemical compounds that are fast becoming a huge health concern. I spoke with Dr. Habibi in his lab at the University of Calgary.
There is an increasing awareness for a presence of environmental contaminants with hormone-like activity, and the concern is some of these compounds could affect human health and wildlife. And the realization actually started back in the early 80s by some British biologists when they realized certain fishes swimming in the water, which they have abnormal characteristics. And they, in some cases, they produce certain proteins, in particular called vitellogenin, which only you see it in female, and the male fish was producing it, and they were asking why. And also, when they look further, they found out some abnormal development. Some of the fishes, which are supposed to be male, were developing ovaries and so on. And so they realized there are some factors in the environment that could contribute to hormone-like activities, and other scientists around the world began to study this. And so the mounting evidence led to sort of an inquiry and a number of key books. One of them actually is Our Stolen Future by Theo Kolbern, that when this book elicits this different response among different groups, because it's some extreme, it includes some extreme references. So for better or worse, this book actually stimulated some response. And at the time, Al Gore, back in 1996, made a foreword in this book and led to the passage of a legislation in the United States in Senate for the Safe Drinking Act. And they charged the Environmental Protection Agency to find out whether there is a problem or not. And they've carried out a massive investigation, and which lasted for almost 5 years, and they came up with the conclusion that yes, there is a significant problem with endocrine disruptors, which means there are compounds in our environment that could either mimic or block natural hormones, so therefore they can be hazardous and could potentially affect normal development. This work was going on, and then they were asking how can we detect that. And the information, I think they've interviewed over 100,000 scientists around the world and a large group. And they found that we're talking potentially about 80,000 chemicals, both synthetic and naturally occurring products that could have hormone-like activity. Because of the overwhelming numbers, they've divided that into 3 groups. The ones that we already have good deal of evidence that they have hazards, such as PCBs and so on. And we're going to leave them aside right now. And then there are other groups that we don't have too much evidence about their hormone-like activity. We can leave those around. But there are certain numbers that there's evidence that they may have hormone-like activity, but we are not sure. The number of those is something like 15,000. And the focus is trying to detect their hazard assessment for those.
Well, when you say numbers like 80,000 and 15,000, that must be just about every chemical compound we know. It sounds like these things are everywhere. Is that the case?
Well, that's true. Potentially, they're. I mean, the compounds that we're talking, they include a certain plant-derived estrogen they call phytoestrogen. In some cases, you can get them from herbal sources, some of the natural products. They can be useful because some of these products have been used in herbal medicine over the past 1,000 years, and they can be useful for people in a postmenopausal situation for osteoporosis and if it's used properly. At the same time, if that kind of a compound is ingested by somebody who's suffering from breast cancer, it can be harmful, so it's important to know. Also, they were dealing with something like organochlorine pesticides, certain herbicides and insecticides, and that includes DDTs and endosulfans, as you might know. DDT has been banned in North America since 1972, but we can still see the traces. In fact, about 2 years ago, there's been studies, including one of my colleagues here, Dr. Su Chan, they've determined the concentration of the endocrine disruptors in amniotic fluid of certain pregnant women at UCLA, and they detected a compound by name of DDE, which is a metabolite of DDT, which indicates they could potentially affect human development, because at that stage, if the steroid level is abnormal, fetus can develop in an abnormal way. In addition, there are other compounds than the plasticizers, some pharmaceutical compounds. There are certain surfactants and detergents which we're particularly concerning here because they use extensively in pulp mills and paper mills. So if you look at the activities downstream from certain rivers, you may find that relatively large concentrations. And there are some industrial chemicals such as PCBs and dioxins and so on. And while some of these compounds are not used, there are certain estrogenic compounds such as nonylphenol and endosulfans, which are still used in most countries, including Canada. So, yes, I mean, potentially we come across these things every day. But the question is, do we know what sort of efficacy they have? Do we know if they're hazardous? Do we know if they are causing harmful effect? All these questions now being answered by scientists. And in our case, we're not necessarily looking at hazard assessment, but we're trying to develop technologies for detecting these chemicals, because we believe in order to do something about it, you should be able to detect these things in a quantitative way. If we are trying to, you know, guide an industry for not to produce it, we have to tell them, first of all, how much they're contributing, and we can try to help them to detect it in future.
What are some of the more specific concerns that you have right now, or areas that you feel that we need to do more work in?
Well, we are focusing on the detection technology. And talking to different groups, people have different concerns. Whether you talk to people in the health sector, they want to know if this has effect on humans. So we're developing assays that that can utilize as a human cells. And so it holds the constructs that are necessary in that. For example, we use certain cancer cells. So one of the concerns is, does it increase the certain proliferation of cancers? As you know, if you look at the statistics over the past 50 to 60 years, there's an increasing incidence of cancer, hormone-dependent cancer. Best examples are breast cancer and prostate cancer. And we haven't changed as a population by mutating. Something changed in our environment. So for those kind of groups, we have assays based on human cells and looking at cell proliferation, looking at expression of specific markers in the cells. And also there is concern by some environmentalists and the people worried about ecosystem. In this case, there's a seepage into the water system, aquatic animals, and what is the effect? And a good evidence is, for example, in certain parts of the world, and in North America, in Florida, in the swamps, there's evidence that alligators are developing abnormally, and this has been in media. And again, these are due to certain androgenic environment compounds. I know that, for example, in North America, in Minnesota, there is a very grave concern over amphibian population disappearing, and they are now related to endocrine disruptors, which have thyroid-like and retinoid-like activity. And also in some part of the parts near the pulp mills, then there's evidence for fishes are abnormally developing, for example, into feminization of certain things. And there's evidence, for example, in human, there is a decline in sperm count, testicular size, and essentially lack of fertility. So all these, we have also an aquatic model, which means we have assays based using fish as a model. In one case, fish can swim in an aquarium containing the contaminated, potentially contaminated product, and we have an endpoint to detect that. And these are reasonably accurate indication whether these compounds are present or not.
Is there any institute or facility that deals with this issue on a bigger scale?
Well, I'm not aware of any in North America, in Canada. In the United States, there are a number of companies that have been contracted by Environmental Protection Agency to help them detect these endocrine disruptors. In Canada, I'm not aware of any companies, and for that reason, I got together with some of my colleagues here at universities, and they include Dr. Su Chan, who's the director for Center for Toxicology, and Dr. Lash Gadamo, who's a professor also in biological sciences. And we've established an endocrine disruptors analytical lab, which is essentially it's a private facility which can provide service to detect these things. It exists right now, but there is not we don't have a location for that because there is no legislation right now and that for detection of endocrine disruptors. So it's difficult to set up a lab with employing people when there is no demand right now. However, I think there will be registration. I think there will be demand. So the technology exists, and we essentially have all the technology, and we can get up and running in a short time. In fact, we're talking with some group, potentially certain oil companies and some of the groups that might be interested in monitoring the endocrine disruptors in an environment. And that could include the government agency, include private sectors. And we've essentially developed this facility. It's important to emphasize that we developed that in a way there's no strings attached to it, because we don't want to be controlled by a big corporation on that, because it's important for this type of facility to be independent and be able to do the work properly and in an accredited way. And we're hoping that this facility can form a basis for introducing certain legislation. I think one of the utilization of this kind of service would be in a nutraceutical industry, because there is a realization that there is a lot of extracts and products on the supermarket shelves, and their claims about the efficacy of these, about the estrogenicity or androgenicity, a certain kind of efficacy they have, but yet there is no requirement for any data or standardization. I think in Canada, these regulations coming. And when that happens, I think they would need to be able to have some data in order to put labels on this product. And then these kind of facilities will become required. And we're hoping that we're there to meet the demand.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That was Dr. Hamid Habibi, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Calgary. Coming up, there's a lot to be said for dirt. As the world becomes more like one big global village, it's imperative that the results of scientific research are comparable, no matter where one is doing his work. That's one of the major areas of concern for delegates to the 7th International Symposium on Soil and Plant Analysis. 250 scientists from 39 different countries are meeting in Edmonton this week. At last night's reception, I had an opportunity to speak with Yash Kalra, the symposium's organizer and chair.
The theme of this conference is improving the methods of development of soil and plant analysis. Precision, and what it entails is when we do the analysis, we want to fine tune them. There are methods for analysis for phosphorus, calcium, magnesium, and so on, and some countries don't have the methods that we use in, say, Canada or USA. So those countries will benefit from this because we will be able to fine tune those methods they're using there.
It's really quite interesting looking through the lineup of the different workshops. There's a whole section that deals with the economics and the social impacts of soil analysis. And I'm just looking at one as an example. The quality of animal and human life is affected by selenium management of soils and crops. Now, what would be the issue or the importance of that?
About selenium, as the paper says, it's by Dr. Gupta and Dr. Gupta. It's a father-son team. The senior Dr. Gupta, he's in Prince Edward Island, Charlottetown, and the junior Dr. Gupta, he's a surgeon actually in the U.S. And this paper deals with selenium. Selenium is very important to crops. So senior Dr. Gupta is talking about effect of selenium on plant growth, whether we should apply selenium or not for certain crops. The junior Dr. Gupta is studying the effects of that on animals. In one of the recent studies he did for calves, if there's selenium deficiency, there are problems, and that's what he's going to discuss. So it's a father-son team, and it's unique because in general, people from soil science, plant science, for example, they will get together. But here it's human and animal. And as you know, in health food stores, if you go there, selenium is a big issue. Even at food stores, you know, like Save On Foods, for example, you can buy selenium. And even there, there's contradictions, though. As some say, you should take only selenium in certain amounts. If you take more, then it's toxicity. And some of the issues, we don't really know whether the soils are deficient or not, because some labs use different methods. And this goes back to the programs we just talked about earlier. The methods that we use have to be uniform. If a scientist in, say, Charlottetown in Canada finds the soil as 1 ppm, 1 part per million selenium. Now, if in Australia they find that 2 ppm and 2 ppm doesn't do any harm, but 1 ppm in Canada does, maybe it's not the selenium content as such, maybe it's the method. Same soil analyzed by 2 different labs, by 2 different methods, will give or can give entirely different results.
Well, it looks like you have a terrific symposium lined up. I wish you all the luck, and I'm going to have to drop by and listen to some of the speakers. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, and please do come and visit us. We will be here for the whole week. Thank you very kindly.
That was Yash Kalra, the organizer and chair of the 7th International Symposium on Soil and Plant Analysis. Coming up, a look at some of the interesting inventions of scientist Bill Kay. After almost 35 years with the Alberta Research Council, Bill Kay hung up his lab coat for the last time at the end of June. June marked the official retirement from his position as process chemical engineer in the Industrial Ecology Department at the ARC. While we may not know it, Bill had a hand in many of the products and processes we use today. I asked him what got him interested in science in the first place.
Well, the general interest in science as in high school. I used to read a lot of science fiction, Heinlein, and beyond that, I lived next door to a number of university students. One was a pharmacist and one was an engineer. And about that time, plastics was becoming part of the wave of the future, and that was in 1948 to 53, in that period after the Second World War. And I thought, gee, I'd like to be a plastics engineer, but there was no such thing at the time. But anyways, I went to the university and took engineering. And when I got out, I didn't get into plastics, but I got into Sherritt Gordon, where I did some investigative work. And that's where the fun began, was the learning of the application of what was in the books to what was in the real world. Then I went to CIL, where plastics was the real wave of the future, polyethylene, and spent 7 years there before I went to the Research Council, where I retired from after over 34 years. And as you say, almost 50 years in engineering and in the sciences, but if you go back into college or university, it is getting to be the 50-year mark.
Well, even though you're retired, it looks like some of the things that you're working on are still just coming out. I'm looking at the newspaper for today, and there's a sulfur fertilizer process that you've developed that's being announced. Could you tell me about this project?
Well, yes, this is the last project I worked with the Research Council in the council's effort to commercialize a lot of their technologies. This is one that I worked on starting in 1991, and it wasn't patented until 2 years ago. And recently this Calgary company had decided that they would be wise to invest in this technology, and they approached the Research Council and took it on, and it looks like it's going to be a real go. And we're still working on some of the developments, but it's just the final polishing up of the process.
What exactly is it?
The process is technology in which sulfur in the molten form is fired into water. It's described in the patent, and when it hits the water, it explodes into many, many tiny particles, micron-sized particles, almost to the size of smoke. The smaller the particle, the whiter it is. So if you look at sulfur in those big blocks off the highway, it's yellow, but when it gets into the micron size, it approaches white. So what we do is we developed a process to produce it in that particle size without grinding. That's the other way of doing it. This way, although the sulfur is hot, it is safe. While you take cold sulfur pellets and you grind it to the same size, you have a very dangerous process in that the dry sulfur has a tendency to explode, and also it will burn, and it's not as safe as it is in our form, where it's kept damp or wet until it's dried into a pellet, which breaks down very easily. So the sulfur is very important, especially in the canola, soybean, and a number of other crops which require high sulfur. What happens in the ground is the smaller the particle, the easier it is for microbes to attack it and convert the sulfur into a soluble, usable form. So micron sulfur gives you great surface area, great attack by microbes, and earlier use for the farmer by the plants that he's going to grow.
There's a number of different developments or inventions that we're familiar with in Alberta that you've had your hand in, and one of the ones I'm thinking of is the recycled plastic that's been used as barriers. How did you get involved in that one?
Well, many years ago, I guess about the same time as sulfur. Early 1990s, one of the companies in St. Albert decided that they wanted to modify one of their products. And as an offshoot of that, we got into the utilization of waste oil containers. And there was a great quantity of them. And so the people I worked with decided that they wanted to give it a try to make a replacement for highway barrier posts. And the outcome of that was I designed the molds that make the barrier posts now, and built an oven that produces a large number of them. And that didn't go very well. It was set aside for a while. And another company came along, and in the last 2 to 3 years has embraced it and has begun to produce them. If you're interested in taking a look at what they look like, there's a whole series of them on Sherwood Park Freeway, going from 34th Street out to Sherwood Park and on both sides of the highway.
You've also started some work on an artificial sweetener. What's that?
Oh, the artificial sweetener. I forgot about that one. That was a major one. This was another one that was started about the same time as the post and the sulfur. This sweetener is it's called steviocide, and many people may have heard of it one way or another. You can find it in health food stores, but it's not as clean and pure as the materials that we developed. The sweetener is would be the best alternative to aspartame or NutraSweet, those materials, because they're chemical in nature, chemical products, while the steviocide is a natural extract from the plant leaf of a steviocide plant. It's, as I said, 300 to 400 times sweeter than sugar. It has a long, long shelf life. It's not affected by acids like NutraSweet or aspartame in pop. The pop really has only a shelf life of about 3 months, whereas the steviocide material is indefinite. And it's a great alternative to those who have diabetes, I believe, because it's been shown not to affect the system, human system, in the same way sugar does. It would be the best alternative, I guess, to aspartame.
You've retired now from the Research Council, but I can't imagine you're retiring as a scientist.
Oh, no. I have had a few sleepless nights lately thinking about, geez, something new that I could do on this sulfur project, or something different that I had designed for a piece of equipment for one of my nephews who's in the electrical business, things like that. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a tinkerer who takes science and makes it work, or tries to make it work.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're welcome.
That was Bill Kay, now retired from the Alberta Research Council, but not from life as an inventor and tinker. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.